Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent and affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. The Roundtable has postponed its previously announced topic to present a special broadcast, Atomic Force, Its Meaning for Mankind. This revelation of the secrets of nature, long mercifully withheld from man, said Winston Churchill, should arouse the most solemn reflections in the mind and conscience of every human being capable of comprehension. The three participants in today's roundtable represent the University of Chicago, which served as a principal center of fundamental research in the development of the atomic bomb, and which this Friday announced the establishment of a comprehensive program for studying the peacetime uses of atomic force. The university has created two institutes, one of nuclear study and one of metal study, with the appointment, among others, of two Nobel Prize winners, Harold Urey and Enrico Fermi. Our participants today are Robert Maynard Hutchins, Chancellor of the University, Reuben G. Gustafson, scientist and Vice President and Dean of Faculties of the University of Chicago, and former President of the University of Colorado, and William F. Ogburn, sociologist and foremost American scholar of the social changes wrought by invention and technology. Mr. Hutchins.
Gentlemen, is the atomic bomb good or bad for the world? Gustafson, what do you say?
On the day the bomb was dropped, I met the director of the university laboratory, which helped to develop the atomic bomb. His first words were, "This is a very sad day for us. Let us hope we've not placed dynamite in the hands of children."
Well, Ogburn, was it wise to use this bomb against Japan?
By ending the war, it saved more lives than were lost at Hiroshima.
Wasn't the war going to end anyway?
But when? The Japanese minister to Sweden said in this morning's paper that the atomic bomb brought the plea for peace. We can't have peace or progress without paying the costs, as Charles Darwin showed.
But this is the kind of weapon that should be used, if at all, only as a last resort and in self-defense. At the time this bomb was dropped, the American authorities knew that Russia was going to enter the war. It was said that Japan was blockaded and its cities burned out. All the evidence points to the fact that the use of this bomb was unnecessary. Therefore, the United States has lost its moral prestige.
At the very least, we might have used another method. We might have demonstrated the effectiveness of the bomb by calling our shot in advance, by giving the Japanese an opportunity to watch us drop a bomb on an uninhabited part of Japan, and then calling upon Japan to surrender.
Well, perhaps the future is more important than the past. Ogburn, as a social forecaster, what seems most important to you about the atomic bomb?
Well, I think this may very well be, Hutchins, the most important invention of all time. The explosive energy in the atomic bomb undoubtedly brightens the prospect for abolishing war, in my opinion. But if, in addition, atomic energy is harnessed, it will usher in, I think, the atomic age, and may produce sweeping changes comparable to those of the Industrial Revolution, which was brought in by steam. The Industrial Revolution, we all know, created our cities, made nations bigger, shifted world powers, weakened the family as an organization, revolutionized agriculture, built up a perfectly enormous industry, and led to the creation of the most powerful central governments the world has ever known.
Gustafson, you're a scientist. What do you say?
I'd say the bomb teaches us the value of fundamental research. The work done by Professor Fermi and others on the effect of the neutron on the uranium atom was research carried out from the point of view of curiosity for the general purpose of increasing human knowledge. There was no specific purpose of producing atomic energy, and certainly no intention of producing world-shattering bombs. The basic work was an attempt to find out something about the universe in which we live. To me, that is the important lesson. That is the way all really important discoveries are made.
My own conviction is that the moral burden which this discovery places upon the peoples of the Earth and the necessity of a world organization to control this force are most important. But let's take up in order the social and industrial consequences, the implications for research, and the impact of this discovery on war, peace, and world organization.
Let us first see what we are talking about, gentlemen. If we are talking, A, about the explosive capacities of uranium only, which is, by the way, the only thing that is known definitely and publicly, that's one thing. If we are talking, B, about harnessing power from uranium and regulating its flow through machines, which is something I haven't yet heard we can do definitely, then the social consequences, of course, will be very much greater. But if we are talking, C, about releasing atomic energy, not from uranium alone, but from other and more abundant materials, such as, for instance, clay or common water, and of this I am skeptical as well as uninformed, then no human imagination can encompass its consequences, in my judgment.
Ogburn, this is the most important discovery that has been made since the discovery of fire. It is more important than all of the inventions since the Industrial Revolution combined. This discovery is the answer to the dream of the alchemist. We are dealing here with the transmutation of elements, the destruction of matter, the liberation of tremendous quantities of energy. Energy the intensity of which defies description. For example, when dynamite explodes, you have an intensity represented by about 4 volts. Now we're talking about something of the order of 200 million volts.
That's truly impressive, but Gustafson, inventions have nearly always been overpromised. 95% of them never materialize at all. Take, for instance, the singing wire or the talking book, which were invented in the 1890s. They haven't been put to public use yet. Or take another invention, that of gas warfare, which put fear in our hearts and was suddenly overpromised 25 years ago at the end of the First World War. It has never materialized up to its promises. My calculation shows that it takes on an average of about 35 years for an invention to materialize, and sometimes it takes 200 or 300 years or longer. All inventions of the past that I have studied have been resisted. Take prefabricated housing, for instance. We could have had it 50 years ago. But instead, it has been resisted by the building trades, certain real estate interests, and of course the mortgage companies. They do not want it.
It seems to me the trend today, however, is away from resistance and towards too ready acceptance of new things. As a people, we are credulous and volatile rather than skeptical and slow to change. Take vitamins and nylon, for example.
But, Gustafson, we mustn't allow ourselves to begin talking like Jules Verne.
This time, Jules is justified.
Yes, but if Jules Verne were sitting on the Chicago Round Table this morning, he would be using the atomic bomb to organize a war on the planet Mars. But there are many, many forces which slow up change. Civilization is really a complicated mass of interrelationships, like a huge piece of machinery. You can't change one part without changing many parts. To bring in a regulated atomic power means, for instance, changing railroads, electric power systems, banks, factories, and many other types of social organization. All this takes time. We don't get inventions adopted overnight.
We may not get inventions overnight, Ogburn, but we do know certain things about this discovery. We do know that we get out of it incredible heat, incredible power, incredible radioactivity, and new elements.
Yes, but Gustafson, there's a third factor, it seems to me, which slows up the use of inventions. An invention will not be used if it costs too much. President Truman, for instance, told us that atomic energy cannot compete in terms of costs with coal or electricity at this stage. The atomic bomb cost, it's reported, $1 billion apiece. You can't pick up a piece of U-235 as cheaply as you can pick up a piece of coal and put it in the furnace. The question still is whether the costs will be brought down cheap enough, and this we certainly do not know yet. Then let's assume that we have a fundamental discovery.
But if we have a fundamental discovery, we have one in a very early stage. And what are the social consequences that you, as a social scientist, can reasonably foresee even at this stage?
I've been trying to argue that we didn't get a case of jitters, that the inventions, though they disturb our sense of security, have a way of developing slowly against what we call social inertia. In the face of resistances arising from the complicated nature of our society and with a handicap of high cost. But to answer your question, Hutchins, if we cannot abolish war, we can pretty well count on a considerable effect, for instance, on the layout of our cities and on city planning. The cities have been displaced, as you know, by the automobile and the railroad, and more recently, of course, by the bomber, which should have displaced them even more. But if explosives of this kind can reach them, our cities will be undoubtedly dispersed and spread outward. This is a tendency already underway.
Can we look forward to more leisure?
Any great new use of energy has the potentialities of reducing, and I may say even abolishing, physical toil. I think we might even look forward into the future to factories without any laborers in them at all. But, of course, this will all come slowly.
Couldn't we have technological unemployment on a scale we've never dreamed of?
We could if the inventions came quickly enough. But most inventions produce technological unemployment only temporarily. Unemployment in the main is really caused by business fluctuations and by population changes. I have calculated, for instance, that during the depressions of 1930, only 15% of it was technological.
Remember, this is a fundamental discovery of very fundamental character that could affect our whole industrial civilization.
Well, what about the effect on the standard of living?
It will make the atomic age an age of abundance. I'm particularly excited, though, about the possibilities for transportation, which I've been studying recently. If atomic energy could be put in a rocket, and that doesn't seem so very difficult, and if these rockets could be kept cool and slowed near their destination, it's perfectly possible, I think, to travel 3,000 miles an hour. This would mean we could leave New York one day and arrive in China the day before.
Who's talking like Jules Verne now?
Let's not forget that the bomb is the end product of a series of discoveries. In all probability, the liberation of atomic power in a fashion that can be controlled for industry will likely be much simpler than making the bomb.
But I'm interested in the suggestion that this discovery will favor the big industries, at least in its present stage, where we have relatively rare materials and a relatively expensive process. How do you gentlemen feel about public versus private control of this material and this process?
Let me give some illustrations on this point. Most of the power inventions that we have now have developed big industries of the public utility type: electricity, railroads, aviation. These are certainly not the industries for small business. I suspect that the development of atomic energy will be in this class. It will tend to strengthen the big industries. It's very likely, by the way, to speed us further on the road to serfdom, as the term is now used. It will tend to reinforce movements toward monopoly and toward cartels, if, of course, we don't do something about it. But if it can be used in very small packages, then it may, of course, not accentuate this tendency. Most probably, however, it will put tremendous power in the hands of large industrial units, and that brings up the question, what are we going to do about it?
It seems to me it will go about the way the development of power in general has gone. We have seen the government step into the power problem to control our great water resources for the development of electrical power. It seems to me we are increasingly coming to the conclusion that anything so fundamental to our economic structure as electricity or power in general has to be something that is government controlled. The government would logically have a lot to say about the development and distribution of atomic power.
I agree. Military reasons, of course, are added to the economic reasons in this case.
So you both feel that on the military side, there is no question that the government will have to continue in control of this process and in control of the materials used in it. But if large industries are the only ones that are in a position to develop the process or exploit the material at the present time, then we shall have to have government regulation of those industries. Gustafson, what are the implications of this discovery for medicine, and for health, and for biology?
They are tremendous, of course. The radioactivity associated with all of this work has great possibilities for good and for harm. Industrial hazards, for example, in the new industries. The exposure of working men to dangers which we never suspected before. We are going to use these radioactive materials, too, in the study of disease processes. We're going to use them in attempting to follow the fundamental researches in biology. The implications for public health, as I have said, probably cannot be overstated.
You think, that is, that we may have as great a revolution in medical treatment and in biological investigation as the revolution that we can see ahead of us in the physical sciences and in technology, is that it?
No question about it.
Well, we come then to the second main point on this roundtable, gentlemen. If the government has succeeded in creating a notable curse with $2 billion and the concentrated effort of thousands of scientists over 4 or 5 years, why couldn't we ask that the government devote the same money and effort to the elimination of some of the already existing curses, such as cancer, influenza, venereal disease, unemployment at home, or starvation abroad?
The important point here, Hutchins, is that while it is relatively easy to get large sums of money to study the cancer problem that you have suggested, it is by no means easy to get large sums of money to study the fundamental properties of living matter. In the last analysis, the solution of the cancer problem will probably be a byproduct of fundamental research on how the cell divides, why it divides. We should remember that the nucleus of the cell is just as important in biology as the nucleus of the atom is to nuclear physics. We should remember, as I said before, that when Professor Fermi did some of the fundamental work leading to the atomic bomb, bombs were the farthest thing away from his thinking. Similarly, the cure for cancer will come, in my opinion, indirectly, out of fundamental research and probably not out of the study of cancer.
But doesn't this mean that such researches would have to be centered in universities rather than in industry or under the auspices of the government?
Hutchins, the history of research has shown, in my judgment, that industry is interested primarily in applied researches. Government is interested in the main and contemporary applications. The only fundamental research that has been done of any significance has been done at the universities. Take, for instance, radio broadcasting and radar. They were dependent upon the discoveries through pure research and pure science by Hertz of the Hertz in waves.
After all, where did the government turn in its hour of great fear? It didn't turn to industry, and it didn't turn to itself. It turned to the universities.
The atomic bomb, Gustafson, has put to the universities the biggest challenge they have ever faced, in my judgment. We've got to know what to do with this murderous weapon which we have created. Without a liberal education, and without spiritual education, it may become our master and our destroyer. What the natural scientists do, you know, is to unleash these inventions which cause a reorganization of society, a reorganization of our political and our economic institutions, our social institutions, and always, of course, and this should not be forgotten, a reevaluation of our ideologies. But here we are sitting around this table trying to give answers in a half an hour when it can't be done. It took $2 billion and 3 years, so we are told, to produce an atomic bomb. If the various social scientists had $2 billion and 3 years of research, we could give better answers. But I think maybe we ought to consider declaring a moratorium on all pure science and on the researches of all natural science development until the social sciences can tell us what to do about it and can catch up.
I understand you're not seriously suggesting a moratorium. You're simply suggesting that Gustafson and I should get out and raise $2 billion for the support of social science research. We'll be glad to do that.
Chicken feed, Hutchins, chicken feed. We need much more than that.
Well, I'd like to consider whether, even if you had $2 billion for social science research, you could have any effect on society if society was not educated enough to accept the results.
That, of course, is the basic problem.
And whether it isn't necessary, therefore, and whether this isn't another of the responsibilities of the university, to develop liberal education for all.
Quite right. Even Harvard and Yale and the University of Colorado, my former institution, have decided at last to devote themselves to general education as a preliminary to specialization. it would seem that this must be the trend, and it must be tremendously accelerated.
If we're going to have a society that knows what to do with these constant surprises from the physical scientists, we're going to have an entirely different level of general intelligence in the community from the one that we've been used to in the past.
That, Hutchins, is really the challenge of the atomic bomb as I see it. The bomb, as we know, paralyzed Japan. But also, we'd like to note that the first week in the atomic age has given the rest of the world a very bad state of jitters, to say the least. But what we really fear, I think, is not the bomb so much as the unknown. But we need not fear it if we can control its development, control the knowledge, and use it consciously and confidently for good and not for evil.
Well, that brings us, doesn't it, to our last point, which is the military and political significance of atomic force.
It's an interesting fact that nations in the past, throughout the long history of mankind, have risen and fallen pretty much on the basis of the inventions of the past. England dominated the world during the 19th century. They did it because of the harnessing of the first mechanical power, steam, which brought the Industrial Revolution to England 50 years before it came to any other country or any other continent. Prior to that, France and the other Western European countries became powers by displacing the Mediterranean countries because of the agricultural inventions of the time, which made the river valleys of Western Europe so very powerful forces. But before that, the Mediterranean country rose to power in antiquity because of another invention, the boat. And now comes along a still more important one, discovery, the atomic energy. Will there be a realignment of powers, of international powers?
Well, what I get out of what you've been saying is that the United States is going to dominate the world because the United States is sitting on this secret.
If the United States tries to sit on this secret, it will make itself the most hated power on the face of the earth. But you can't sit on this secret. If the history of science shows anything, it shows that discoveries are made practically simultaneously in several parts of the world. But no single nation develops an idea of this kind. As you well know, Hutchins, if you look over the men who are going to work at the University of Chicago in the Institute of Nuclear Physics, you will find that they come from practically all over the world, from Italy, from Hungary, England, Canada, as well as the United States. This bomb was a composite that grew out of the efforts of many people. If any one nation attempted to isolate itself scientifically, it would soon be outstripped by the others, which would not be parties to the secrecy.
Brains, in the hereditary sense, as you biologists know, Gustafson, are pretty generally distributed evenly over the world. The thing we got to look out for, though, is what is the distribution of the natural resources of this new source of power. Where do we find uranium? In Colorado, in Utah, and in Canada. But it also exists in Czechoslovakia, in Africa, and in Russia. That puts it in the hands of what we call the peace-loving nations. May I say that I hope they will continue to love peace.
Your implication that the release of atomic energy is limited to uranium is open to question. In all probability, we shall learn to apply the process to other more abundant elements. It seems to me that this discovery really equalizes the nations by placing atomic power with all of its potentialities in the hands of small nations. What we have done is the equivalent of placing a slingshot in the hands of a David.
Not yet, Gustafson. The chances are strong that the difference between the big nations and the small nations will be increased rather than diminished. That's what happened with the tank and the bomber. They practically killed off the small nations as effective factors in the distribution of power. The atomic bomb will very likely strengthen the big nation because whatever the little one can do, the bigger one can do it better and quicker.
But your assumption is that it takes tremendous industry and a lot of airplanes to do this sort of job. It's altogether possible that relatively small numbers of workers in a small country, such as Denmark, could develop all the facilities that are necessary without a single bomber. With only, say, a runaway, a rocket, and an atomic bomb man in Copenhagen, you could destroy Berlin.
Still, I maintain that the big nations can still produce bigger and better and quicker results. What do you think, Hutchins?
The first thing I think is that peacetime military training in the United States now becomes an irrelevant issue. You don't need a big army to operate an atomic bomb. You don't need much of an air force. Peacetime conscription is a soporific. We should not rely on large masses of half-trained men. We should pin our faith on scientific research.
At the present stage, uranium is known to be distributed only in certain places. Manpower and industrial strength related to its use are, of course, important. The issue is whether, as scientific research proceeds, it will not result in the further distribution of power, which might bring the smaller nations back to the same level. But the upshot in any case is that the atomic bomb cannot be suppressed. Ogburn, by talking about the abolition of war, did you mean something like the United Nations might abolish war by agreement now that the atomic bomb has fallen?
Gustafson, it's the best chance to banish war we've had since the League of Nations. At least to banish it for a time, and I hope a very, very long time.
I don't follow you at all. After the last war, it was said that the aeroplane and the TNT bomb were going to be so horrible that nobody would ever fight again. And Hitler began to fight as soon as he saw that he had industrial resources and a political position adequate to give him a good chance of success. Isn't that always going to be the case? You're not going to abolish war merely by making it horrible.
People are going to fight for whatever they think they can win. They always have and they always will.
The Japanese apparently thought it was too horrible. But don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that we can abolish war forever. About all we can do, I think, is to look forward about 20 or 25 years. The problem is practically, though, to make war more difficult. If the atomic bomb has all the destructive capacities, it may be our golden opportunity.
We've always had this chance, and we've... And the whole question is, what is at stake, and what are your chances? If a man has a chance to dominate the world through the control of atomic energy, that's a very large stake. And if he has, through the advances made by the scientists in this country, an opportunity to use this atomic force in such a way as to justify him in thinking that he has the edge on his enemies, he will take advantage of his situation and start another international conflagration. How are you going to prevent this? Did I understand you to say that you thought we could have an international agreement which would either stop scientific progress in weapons or make every nation feel that it should never take advantage of such progress?
Such an agreement is not impossible, certainly.
The question is not whether it is impossible, but whether it would be effective. Up to last Monday, I must confess that I didn't have much hope for a world state. I have believed that there was no moral basis for it existed, that we had no world conscience and no sense of world community sufficient to keep a world state together. But the alternatives now seem clear. One is world suicide. Another is agreement among sovereign states to abstain from using the bomb. This will not be effective. The only hope, therefore, of abolishing war is through the monopoly of atomic force by a world organization.
That's 1,000 years off.
Remember that Léon Blois, the French philosopher, referred to the good news of damnation. Doubtless on the theory that none of us would be Christians if we weren't afraid of perpetual hell fire. It may be that the atomic bomb is the good news of damnation, that it may frighten us into that Christian character and those righteous actions and those positive political steps necessary to the creation of a world society, not 1,000 or 500 years hence, but now.
You may purchase a printed word-for-word copy of today's special University of Chicago roundtable on Atomic Force, Its Meaning for Mankind, for 10 cents in coin. For $1, you may purchase roundtable transcripts for the next 26 weeks. Address your orders and any comments you may have about today's roundtable to the University of Chicago roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Participating in today's discussion of Atomic Force, Its Meaning for Mankind, were Robert M. Hutchins, Chancellor, Reuben G. Gustafson, Vice President, and William F. Ogburn, Distinguished Service Professor of Sociology, all of the University of Chicago. Be sure to listen next week when the Roundtable will do a special broadcast entitled, Is America Unprepared for Peace? The Roundtable today originated in the Mitchell Tower Studios of the University of Chicago. The National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations have cooperated in the presentation of this discussion. This is a public service program which brings the American listener various shades of opinion on important public issues. Programs in this series of particular interest to servicemen and women are broadcast overseas through the worldwide facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Bob Farrell speaking. This is the National Broadcasting Company.